Hello, everybody, and welcome to Whispers Radio here on AM 1600 WKKX, the Valley's Watchdog, and UPRN, the UFO Paranormal Radio Network. It is 36 degrees here in downtown Wheeling. I'm Jordan Klein. She's Lola Miller. And the lovely Lola Miller. That's the first time I introduced you without some lovely.
Uh-huh. See how? I'm sliding quickly in the ranks.
Oh.
Yeah.
Sorry.
We're the only ones that appreciate you.
I know you are.
I should pump you up. The magnificent Lola Miller.
Yes, uh-huh.
You see, you got your own horns too.
Yeah, I guess.
And Sarah Howard, how you doing, Sarah?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing good. I'd tell you the time, but I guess the clock went missing, and all my clocks are something else.
It is 6:08.
6:08 p.m.
Yes.
And we've already got our guest on the line too.
Yes, we do.
Our guest tonight, Mr. Micah Hanks. We're talking, ghosties and Bigfoot and what else we can scrape out of this guy. Micah, you there?
Absolutely. Jordan, great to be back on the program with you.
We're good to have you, too. It's May? We had you last time?
Been a while. It's definitely been a little while. So, when you're in my line of work, you know, temporality is something that you begin to pay far less attention to. And those matters having to do with space and time are kind of irrelevant. So maybe
there we go.
Some it seems just like yesterday. But glad to be here regardless.
We'll go. Man, it's been like yesterday since we heard you. So you've been working on a book.
I'm actually sitting here right now at my desk working on a book, and it's a proposal for one book, and then I'm about 25,000 words into another one. So, you know, that's kind of how it goes. If you're really serious about this stuff, you got to be able to juggle real well and stay real busy and hope that, you know, that your eyes are going to hold out for the long haul while you stare into that, veritable retina-burning monster that is a laptop computer.
Yep.
Well, tell us about what you're working on here.
Well, you know, one of the book proposals has to do with UFOs, and that's going to be, it's actually something a little different. I think that most people, when they talk about UFOs, think about, well, for instance, with the popularity of a program like Ancient Aliens on the History Channel, everybody tends to think maybe that aliens have already, you know, kind of managed to get a hold on intelligence and technology that far, far surpasses what we know here as humankind. And maybe they've even, you know, throughout the epochs and the ages, managed to influence humankind with that kind of technology. Maybe they visited us in ancient times, and so this idea of paleo contact comes to mind. On the other hand, I see that fewer researchers out there tend to look at the future and say, well, could it be that there are things about, the coming years and future technology that might yield some potential in helping us understand UFOs? And I think when you especially look to the future at something like technological singularity, a point where greater than human intelligence emerges from our own technology, artificial intelligence and these sorts of things, I think that there's a tremendous potential there for explaining a lot of the kind of UFO phenomenon that we see around us in the world today. And yet, even though I think that that's, you know, fairly logical, and I think that that's, a unique way, if nothing else, to go about trying to understand UFOs, I still get smacked in the face with these people who say, well, yeah, but what you're talking about is entirely speculative, and there's therefore no scientific credence to it.
Isn't that with most of this field?
Right? You know, I mean, that's the thing. But let me ask you this. Did Einstein never stand out on a clear night and look at the stars and wonder what else might exist out there? You know, I find that in the scientific community, not everyone thinks this way, but there is, at very least, I think, a greater, margin of quote-unquote scientists, you know, who tend to kind of close themselves off and say, nope, we can't allow ourselves to speculate anymore. We have to only deal with that which we know. And if that, my friends, is not any kind of way to grow.
Well, see, you say that now, but then you have Einstein's theory was just a theory of revolution.
Relativity.
Relativity, whatever it is. I am not an educator. Well, I guess I went to college, but...
There you go, though. But what you outlined, though, is absolutely right, is that it was a theory, and there are constantly, revisions that are being made to what we'll say, to kind of paraphrase what you were saying there, Jordan, Einstein's revolutionary theory of relativity. So
there we go. See, we were both right.
There you go. Exactly. I wouldn't let my brother be hanging out there.
There we go.
Come on, I got you. I got your back. But so the whole thing is that, yes, when it's a theory, that means that it is not fact, it is not law, it is not gospel. But many in the scientific mainstream tend to forget that, and therefore they disclude the possibility of speculation, even when there is some empirical data and some fact to back that up. So I hope to bring to the field of ufology an innovative way of looking at this phenomena that incorporates the likely potentials that our future technology here on Earth may yield, and it may help us to understand what this obviously greater than human intelligence is in our presence here and now.
Now, is UFOs, is that a new field for you?
You know, UFOs has been something that I've been interested in probably since about, age five. I came across a book of Ray Fowler's called UFOs Interplanetary Visitors. Now, looking back, I can see the inherent problem with that title. It has long been supposed that UFOs, that is, unidentified flying objects, are indeed the representative, rather, of an intelligence that comes from outside our planet Earth. In other words, an intelligence that is extraterrestrial, alien to this world, and visits from another star system or galaxy. I'll tell you this. Scientifically, there's very little evidence to support that. There's plenty of evidence that supports that there are strange objects flying around out there, whatever they may be. But, you know, we can't say that they are with certainty from another planet or from another galaxy. But your short answer to the question is, yeah, I've been interested in that for a long time, and I think it's taken me this long now. I'm 28 years old now, and it's taken me since age 5 and first coming into that stuff to finally begin to look at this and say, you know what, maybe we need to change the way we're looking at this. I'm not saying they aren't aliens or that they aren't, you know, Zeta 2 reticulans or reptoids that are abducting people and doing ungodly things to their bowels, you know, in the evening. But the thing is that we have to explore other possibilities as well.
Now, you're working on two books. What's your other one?
The other one, and this is probably the one that would be of greater interest to your listenership, this one has to do with ghosts and hauntings. That's something that, you know, when I began to get really seriously interested in the strange and the unusual, I think was probably, at least for me, what I would consider to be most accessible. Everybody will tell you a story about how, you know, I think just about everybody at least knows someone who will tell them a story or who has told them some sort of a story along the lines of, yeah, you know, I went in that house, or Ma used to say that she'd go and stay out there in the country and everything, and that the old barn was haunted, or something strange would go on in there, or the old church, there was a specter that was seen in there. And certainly living in a southern town like Asheville, North Carolina, which is riddled with history and intrigue, there are a lot of locations around here that are purported to be haunted, and one of those is a place called the Reynolds Mansion. It's a 1847 antebellum mansion that was built as a private home, you know, of course, prior to the Civil War. And like a lot of old buildings, you know, of its make and model, it is certainly purported to be very haunted. And so I've had a great time writing a book that details my own investigations there, as well as the very unique history of this place. So that's the other book.
How many times have you investigated it?
Well, you know, the thing is, it's been an ongoing situation. I was invited there by a friend of mine just probably, I think it was probably around the time I first came onto your program. And when I went up there the first time, she had just said, you know, you ought to come up here because there are a lot of stories about ghosts and things that are seen here, particularly a young girl's ghost, which many there believe to be a member of the Reynolds family for whom the building is named. They refer to her as Annie Lee Reynolds. And for whatever reason, even though Annie Lee lived to be into her 80s, the ghost of this girl resembles photographs of a young Annie Lee Reynolds that still exist there at the house. I started going there again probably in the late spring, early summer of this year, and initially it was just to take a private tour because they knew I was interested in ghosts and things like that.
Uh-huh.
I was invited back. I was told more stories. You know, people who would stay there, because the building is now a bed and breakfast, so they have guests that come through every week. This place has literally gotten to a point where there are so many people staying there, and the popularity of this place, thanks to websites like TripAdvisor.com, you know, it has gotten so popular in the Asheville area that there are so many people that come through on a weekly basis, and many of them do talk about having had experiences where they've seen or felt things there. And just to kind of tell you how popular this place has gotten, as I understand, I think it is number two in the nation right now on TripAdvisor.com, and I believe it's okay to go ahead and say publicly that they've also been ranked number 12 in the world. They just got an email about this the other day. So there's obviously something about this location that just draws people. It's a three-story, 18-room, antebellum bed and breakfast, and yes, indeed, many of the people who stay there say, yeah, they've had experiences with different things. So that's kind of what comprises this news story, and it definitely kind of taps into that whole Southern Gothic thing. There are ironic instances of strangeness that incorporate what I think indeed are something supernatural.
Now, what are some of the sightings? Are they seeing full-body apparitions? Are they, you know... Was there one place that Taps went to where glass was breaking? you know, in the middle of the night? What kind of things is going on there?
You know, to tell you the truth, I think actually that the TAPS guys had at one point visited the Reynolds Mansion, if I remember correctly. A number of other people have, too. Also, Joshua P. Warren, who's a very well-known paranormal investigator.
Uh-huh.
Joshua has visited the Reynolds Mansion, and I think that he actually went with a film crew on at least one occasion and filmed a short segment about ghost hunting in a haunted location. He did that there as well. So it's gotten a lot of attention from people, and those who have gone there and investigated and also those who have shared their own encounters have described not only seeing full-body apparitions, particularly of a young girl who is often seen descending or ascending the primary staircase that leads from the first floor up toward the second floor of the building. Actually, it goes all the way to the third floor as well, but it's between the first and second that generally this spirit of a young girl has been seen. There's also a gentleman who has a beard, who's fairly tall, who is seen around the first floor. Some believe it may be Daniel Reynolds, who is, of course, the man who built the Reynolds Mansion, and therefore it is named for he and his family. So those are the kinds of things that happen there, but there are other circumstances that people have described as well. There's a bedroom known as Maggie's room, a guest room on the third floor, which many people have said is one of the more haunted rooms in the building. And I've had a lot of folks say that they've had strange things, like they'll come in, and then they'll put all their stuff on the bed, and then they'll leave and go have dinner, and when they come back, they've found that some of their belongings have been moved off the bed as though someone in that room didn't want things piled on the bed.
Really?
Yeah. Another group, and this is even more interesting, another couple had gone to the Reynolds Mansion and stayed there in Maggie's room and literally said that that when they came in, that all their belongings had been piled up against the door. They were trying to open their door, and they couldn't get in there.
Like from the inside?
From the inside.
Oh.
Now, that's pretty interesting. The only way to get into the room otherwise, because there's the main entrance there from the hallway, the only other way to get into that room would be to scale along the roof from the outside of the third floor of this building. So there's going to be a good, 40 or better foot drop, if you're going to fall off the side there. You'd have to scale along the outside of the building to get into one of the windows from the exterior in order to do that. And in order to be able to get back into their room, that's exactly what one of the innkeepers had to do in this instance. They had tried their key and couldn't unlock the door. And so Billy Sanders, the innkeeper, was contacted, and they had to actually have somebody crawl along the outside of the building there to get back in so that they could get there into their room where their belongings had been piled up against the door. So, as is often the case in ghostly circumstances and places that are purported to be haunted, there's a mischievous element that's seen there at Reynolds Mansion, too. And I'm sure that a lot of that's going to make it into the book as well.
Where is it located? I'm trying to find it online.
You should be able to find it. The websites could be the Reynolds Mansion. I believe actually the Reynolds Mansion Bed and Breakfast. But the easiest way to find that, I'll get that for you right now because I've actually got it right here.
Yeah, it's Reynolds, in Asheville, North Carolina.
Yeah, Asheville, North Carolina. It's thereynoldsmansion.com. That's the website. It's actually located right between the little township of Woodfin and Greater Asheville, North Carolina, here in Western North Carolina. And I happen to be an Asheville resident myself, and hence how I came to find this.
But I love Asheville.
It's beautiful. And I have to tell you that, in addition to being a beautiful town, Reynolds Mansion, of course, is itself a beautiful building, too. It's not some old, decrepit house. It's been, formerly...
It's pretty.
Yeah, it's been completely renovated and actually restored. I think they've actually received awards for the renovations that have occurred there. But it's a fantastic place, but it's certainly not without its own degree of strangeness. And, of course, that's what attracts me to it.
Have you been in the Biltmore Estate? Is haunted too? Heard it is.
Well, I've heard stories that the Biltmore Estate is haunted. And for those who aren't familiar with what the Biltmore Estate is, this is probably the largest private home in America. At one time, it was built, of course, by George Vanderbilt, who was the famous wealthy entrepreneur who came to reside here in Asheville, North Carolina. He bought a tremendous tract of land, a lot of which is actually owned by the Pisgah National Forest now, or rather by the Park Service. But the Biltmore House is such a tremendous, it's more like a castle, really. You can't really just call it a house. And yes, I've heard that it is purported to be haunted as well.
Wow. I'm looking at some of these pictures of these rooms. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wow. We got a phone call.
Yep. It's Hank.
Hey, Hank.
Good evening.
How you doing?
I have a question for your guest.
Yes, sir.
With all the hauntings and the different places that are allegedly haunted, what's the fear? Ghosts don't hurt anyone, do they? Have you ever had an occasion where a ghost hurts anyone? I've never heard of a ghost hurting anyone. I'll hang up and listen.
Sure.
Thanks, Hank.
Hank, that is a really good question, and I'm glad you bring that up because that's something I'd like to address. Why is it that people are afraid of ghosts? I think that there are a number of reasons for that. The first being that when we see a ghost or an apparitional form, we tend to think of that as being something that is, in all likelihood, the spirit of a dead person, and hence there's this kind of unearthly, macabre, sense of it, where it's something that is transcending the grave.
Uh-huh.
I think that is inherently creepy for people. On a more base level, I think also that that is something that is so entirely unnatural based on the conventions of what we expect in our everyday lives that it is something that people are terrified of virtually just because it is different. In other words, we fear what we don't understand. And I think that the whole fear of life after death, I don't think that that's something that's terrifying for people in some cultural context. I mean, when we think of heaven and going on and, living forever, in the afterlife and all this kind of stuff, that's a very hopeful notion for especially those of the religious persuasion. So it's funny how in some circumstances life after death isn't frightening at all. For others, it's a terrifying thing. And because of that fear of the unknown, that has been something that has entirely been capitalized on by Hollywood and by books and film. And therefore, this macabre element, this terror that is associated with ghosts and hauntings, I think is essentially really just kind of a cultural artifact, and it's something that's been used primarily for entertainment purposes. Unfortunately, a lot of people who get into this and are interested in this don't draw the distinction between movies and film and that representation of what a ghost is, and then what it's really like to go into a place like Reynolds Mansion, for instance, or even the Biltmore House, and if you see something incredible in a location like that, I think that people kind of associate that with what they have seen and experienced in films and books they've read, and they don't draw the distinction, and therefore they view that as something that's frightening. But I don't think, like Hank had said, I don't think that there are many instances where people have really, really been hurt by something. There are a few stories, where people have claimed that they've been attacked, and you do hear those kinds of things in the literature, but it's not a very common occurrence. Now, I'm sure that there are going to be people who'd probably be listening to this and thinking, oh, yeah, boy, he's wrong. But then again, I think that based on individual experiences, there are a lot of different ways that can be interpreted. Many people feel that they've been harmed in the instance where there's been something psychic or otherworldly going on. But I don't know that we can really say that ghosts have a reputation for beating people up or anything like that.
Yeah, we've had some people on said ghosts can scrape or... Didn't we had one lady who said that ghosts couldn't hurt you, but one tried to push her down a flight of stairs.
Yeah, now I don't know how you they can't hurt you, but they can shove you down a flight. I mean, that makes no sense, but.
Right. Well, that's a little contradictory.
Yeah.
I'll tell you something else. I've also spoken with, a number of individuals, ladies who, and it's funny because I remember I visited, talking about haunted places, about twice a year, I visit an island off the coast of South Carolina called Dolfusky Island. Have either of you ever heard of Dolfusky Island?
No.
I'd never heard of it before I went there. But, yeah, again, you go on that place, and it's incredible. There's a beach on, I guess, what's the north end of the island called Bloody Point.
Nice.
It's one of those places that definitely has kind of a lingering spookiness to it. And while I was there on Dolfusky Island, there's a popular restaurant and kind of a night spot there on the island called Marshside Mama's that my good friend Beth owns. And I was there having dinner, and somehow I struck up a conversation. No, I think it was actually a friend of mine who was there with me, struck up a conversation with a woman. And he came to me and says, you need to talk to this girl. She's got something to tell you. And she starts talking about some of her own ghostly encounters and says that, indeed, during the course of her encounters, that she was sexually assaulted by what she called a spirit entity.
Now, would that be the incubus?
That is the popular notion of what this is, or the classical notion, I guess, is that, there's the incubus and the succubus, which are essentially spirit, manifestations that can kind of interact with a person in a sexual manner and often for purposes of stealing their energy. I think in a lot of these circumstances, and I don't mean this in any way to take away from the validity of what people who've had these experiences are claiming, but I do think that there's a psychological element to this. I don't think that there is anything more invasive, especially on a psychological level for us, than the act of sexual assault. And therefore, when a person is going through, for instance, this individual told me that she was going through a dark period in her life. She felt like her family had disowned her. She had fallen away from the church. She just felt like, everything. I think she'd had some substance abuse and things that were going on. And incidentally, she also said that she began to be accosted by a leather-skinned demon with glowing red eyes that would sexually assault her in the evening.
Wow.
Yeah. But when she, of course, went to a church, she said she fell onto her knees in the church, and she started talking with a minister and started getting her life back on track, getting off the habit and everything, and getting on a healthier mode of thinking and living as well, this entity left and wouldn't bother her anymore. So I do think that sometimes there's a psychological angle that can be attributed to this. And actually, in one of the three series of anthologies that have been put out by New Page Books earlier this year, the second of this three-part series was Ghosts, Spirits, and Hauntings, Am I Being Haunted? And I actually had an essay in this anthology that kind of dealt with some of the psychological angles that can be associated with this. The essay was titled Psychic Gift or Psychotic Nightmare, The Biology of the Supernatural. And in that, I kind of look at not only the psychological angle, but also the way that certain hallucinations and certain hallucinatory substances can evoke experiences that are remarkably similar to some people's experiences with what they think are ghosts and spirits. But what we have to do is we have to also draw a distinction there as well, because while some of these experiences are similar in nature to hallucinations, not everyone who claims that they've seen a ghost or something like that is on, substance, a hallucinatory substance or an entheogenic psychedelic substance. I'm not making a claim that everybody who's seeing ghosts is, also likely taking drugs. But I do want to say that there are certain similarities between some of the mental disorders and psychoses that erupt, like schizophrenia and things like this, and then also the use of certain hallucinatory drugs, and then finally certain people's experiences with ghosts and spirits and things like that. And I don't think that we should rule out those parallels, because by studying those interrelationships, we may come to a better understanding of what exactly is happening when a person sees a ghost or claims that they've seen a ghost. See, I've never seen one, but I can't rule out the fact that many people probably have, and they come to me and they tell me very vivid descriptions like the one I just shared about their own experiences seeing these sorts of things.
Well, now, you've said you've never seen one. What types of experiences have you had personally?
I'll tell you this, Jordan. At Reynolds Mansion, the first night that they ever invited me to stay there, and I'll go ahead and say this too, that while there is some scientific basis for why these sorts of events, these ghostly kind of manifestations and things may occur at night, many people associate midnight with being the witching hour and things like that. I think that there's a certain misconception that you have to be in such an environment in the middle of the night for ghosts to start appearing. There have been far more instances at Reynolds Mansion, for instance, where people have claimed to have seen a full-body apparition in the broad daylight. And they say, if anything, it's right around 3 o'clock, maybe between 3 and 4:30 in the afternoon, that most of these apparitions actually tend to occur. Now, that said, what kind of thing have I had happen there? The first evening that I actually spent all night at Reynolds Mansion, I was there in the entire house by myself. I was armed with, just a notepad and a pen and my watch. And the reason for that is that a lot of people will take these devices, like electromagnetic field detectors and things in the building with them.
Yeah, that's us.
Now, I don't think that there's anything wrong with those, but I do find that for me, I tend not to gravitate toward using those kinds of things. I have used them heavily in the past, but the reason for that is that while the lower-grade EMF detectors, like, for instance, there's the Dr. Gauss, and there's a similar model, I think, called the Gauss Master, while those will certainly react to various different kinds of energies in an environment, what I've found is that you've got to keep in mind those kind of consumer-grade EMF detectors are calibrated to detect natural EM sources, especially those coming from a wall or from maybe like a fluorescent light, a television, even a microwave oven. And they were designed for purposes of being able to calibrate safe distances from certain objects in the home that emit electromagnetic fields, and also maybe even determine where there is harmful EM leakage, like if you've got a microwave or something like that that's releasing an exorbitant amount of electromagnetic radiation. And, of course, some studies have shown that can be dangerous, especially for pregnant women and young children. So that's what these things are designed for. I find it very interesting, therefore, that when they're calibrated for finding kind of manufactured sources of electromagnetic radiation in an environment, people are using those in haunted houses trying to find something that should be a more natural kind of field. Now, then there's the electromagnetic field detector popularly used by the ghost hunters and the like, the tri-field natural EM detector. And I've used one of those.
Is that the K2?
I think that may be. I know that there's a second model that came out. The tri-field is actually, you can find it online. Just do a search for tri-field, T-R-I-field, natural EM meter. There was also a second version of it that came out, and that may be what you're referring to there, where you can hook an antenna or a probe to the device and kind of, again, broaden the field that it's able to observe. But that said, I think that there's a problem inherent with that as well, because often these devices are used when there's a person nearby, and you'll be able to see very clearly that the object reacts to the biofield emitted by a person. I mean, a human creates an electromagnetic field, and these devices will interact with that, and they will, you know, react based on that. They'll squeal if you've got them set to do that, or you'll see the meters begin to kind of move. Now, what I say is that in all likelihood, the electromagnetic field, that biofield that's produced by a human, is produced by the physical body. We are bioelectric in nature, and our bodies produce these kinds of things. So when we have a tri-field, for instance, sitting in a haunted environment or an area purported to be haunted, what about that environment would cause these objects to behave as though a human were present when there is no physical body present? I think that obviously, the implication there is that the electromagnetic presence that these meters seem to be able to interact with is something that we perceive as being that which exists beyond the confines of the physical body. Perhaps the soul has some electromagnetic presence about it, or perhaps the manifestation of a spirit involves some electromagnetic presence. But the problem is that we cannot state with certainty or at least scientifically, that that is indeed what's happening. And so to justify the claims of apparitions appearing in an environment with an EMF detector when we can't prove that really is kind of problematic. That very well may be what's happening, but how do we prove it? You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So in my case, I have kind of taken to leaving the EMF detectors and things at home. And as a good friend of mine who formerly worked at Bell Laboratories said, Micah, you'll find that the human body is the best device capable of measuring those kinds of presences in an environment. And I will sit in a room very quietly. I will observe the environment. I will listen. I will wait. And although I have never seen a full-on apparition or a body, that appears or something like that, you hear strange sounds. You get strange sensations. You hear things sometimes. And I think that there's a lot that probably could stand to be gained from learning to kind of tap into your environment and wait and see what actually is observable there in the here and now. Now, one thing I do implement often with regard to psychic research is the recording of audio in an environment, because I've always been fascinated by
electronics. EVPs?
Yes. EVP is fascinating stuff. And have either of you ever experienced or experimented with that much?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Definitely.
I have no luck with anything. I'll just put it out there. It's, a ghost could come up, sit on my lap, kiss my neck, and I would go, yeah, okay. It's pathetic. I'm pathetic. So if you don't want to have an experience, take me with you.
Well, see, I tell people the same sort of thing, Lola. But, I think that there's this kind of, the reality TV shows that portray psychic investigation and ghost hunting, as it were, they'd like you to think that every time you go to a haunted house, you're going to have incredible things happen. That is the case sometimes, but it's a far lesser margin than the number of times that you'll go and you'll sit in a great big spooky building by yourself and have absolutely zilch, nada, nothing happen. So again, that's the kind of thing that I've experienced time and time again. And frankly, although I've observed what we might call unexplainable transient energy fields that move through an environment that, a tri-field or another electromagnetic field detector can observe and they can react with, I couldn't tell you what actually causes that. And again, I think that my own logical thought process applied to that kind of makes it difficult for me to say that I can use something that we can't explain as evidence for something that we can't explain. In other words, we don't know what that energy field is, but we can assume maybe a ghost produces that. But that's not going to provide proof for something that, again, is unexplained. You can't create a positive by putting two negatives together like that. Now, electronic voice phenomenon, on the other hand, again, is something that's very seldom, successful when you go into an environment. I don't often go into an environment with a dynamic microphone and sit down and start asking questions and just hear a conversation with a ghost who's wanting to tell me its last story. I do know a lot of individuals who have had an incredible success rate with this kind of thing, and it tells me one of two things: that either these people are out-and-out liars and that they're really scamming people, or that in certain circumstances there are presences, whatever they may be, maybe also that are capable of being recorded audibly through some electromagnetic process, and that these voices seem to indicate things about a location or an individual that pertain to the past. So, and that's why I think electronic voice phenomenon remains so incredible. There are a number of books written about it, and maybe the two of you are familiar with Mark Cowden's book, Spirit Voices. Have you seen this one yet?
No.
Oh, you should get Mark on the program. Mark's book is billed as being a book about the first real-time live conversation with a spirit from another world, or you know, from the realm beyond.
Now, how is it? Every time I think of this, I think of the Herb Street method.
Yes.
And you think of the what now?
Herb Street.
It was a guy we had on here. We brought him to a
ghost hunt at the West Virginia Pen with us.
And it was...
Oh, my gosh.
I wanted to kick him in the face.
Tell me about this. I've got to hear about this. Tell me about it.
I don't know what he was doing exactly.
we haven't figured it out yet.
But he got angry at the tour guide. And all of a sudden, his EVP that he was getting was... What do you think of the tour guide? She's crazy. You know, yeah. It's like
he heard there were voices on his recorder all the time. And other people
weren't just voices. I mean, they were voices relevant to how angry he was.
And then other people were recording at the same time that he was, and yet nothing ever showed up on theirs. It was very strange. And he claimed that the whole drive from wherever he was, somewhere in Pennsylvania, here, he was talking with spirits. Just, I guess they're like hanging out on the freeway. I don't know. But he had, you know, all this recorded evidence. And he's one of the ones that believes in, and I think it makes sense to me. If you're going to ask questions, ask a question. Give whatever might be there an opportunity to answer, then play it back to see if you've gotten an answer. How rude is it to sit there and ask questions, perhaps get answers, but you don't listen for hours, you know?
But which is the usual way to do it.
Anyway, this guy,
Every time I hear somebody having EVP conversations with a ghost, I think of that, and I cringe just a tad.
Well, I guess then what you took from that was that this guy was probably fraudulent, right?
Well,
that would be putting it lightly.
Yes.
And that's the thing is that, you know, I
hope I don't get sued for saying it. Can I?
No. That's okay, man. Just put it all out there. You know? But yeah. I tell you, the thing is that in this line of work, you know, a lot of people are kind of perturbed by the fact that I call myself a skeptic. I'm not a debunker. I don't want to put that out there, right up front. I'm not someone who goes around, you know, you're not going to sit down and have a conversation with Micah Hanks, and I'm going to sit there and roll my eyes and go, uh-huh, yeah. No, I'm obviously interested in this sort of stuff. But, you know, I've found that over time you have to be very discerning, and you have to be very skeptical, because if you aren't and if you're not careful, there are people who really they'll play you for everything you're worth. And I spoke with a fellow recently. This guy, he listens to my podcast, because I do a podcast called The Graylian Report.
Yes.
And this gentleman, he was a listener to the podcast, and he came to the Asheville area, and he said, you know, I tell you, Mike, I'm interested in Bigfoot. And Jordan, since you mentioned Bigfoot earlier, although I've got one more really good ghost story I've probably got to share with you before the end of the hour.
Let's see. Oh, we got like 15 minutes left. We're good.
Yeah, okay. But you mentioned Bigfoot, so I should throw this one in there because it relates to what we're talking about. And the general credulity present among a lot of people in this field. He said, I love your podcast. I want to meet up with you sometime if you wouldn't mind. Maybe we can have some coffee, and you know, maybe my wife will let me out long enough to come up and chat with you, because I've got some interesting stuff I want to tell you about Bigfoot. Okay. So I go to meet the fellow and everything, and he sits down, and we're talking, and I figure maybe he was going to tell me just some really bizarre stories about his experiences with Bigfoot and things like that. He had one or two. He'd been out in the woods, you know, and he'd actually gone out on one of these investigations with the Bigfoot Field Researchers Organization and everything, and he'd been all by himself alone, more than a mile from the base camp, and didn't have any reason to be afraid because he's an avid outdoorsman. And then he starts having little stones and little things being thrown at him, and then he's hearing the footsteps, and at one point he said he's overtaken with an irrational sense of fear and is running full throttle down this road back toward the camp because he says he's absolutely just overtaken with an inexplicable fear. Now, the reason I bring this up is because he says, I have had that experience. I've been out there in the woods, Micah, and I had that happen, and I've been hooked ever since. But most of the people I go to talk to about their own experiences with Bigfoot, he says, you know, this guy, I have to say, he's a trained journalist. He's written for outdoor magazines and all different kinds of, you know, different mediums for years and years and years. And he said, I can sit there and I can listen to him talk, and I don't know if it's just something that you develop as a journalist, but you can tell when a person is lying to you, and more than 90% of these people who talk about their experiences with Bigfoot, he says, are liars. You can tell that they are liars. And I'm not saying that the thing doesn't exist, because I believe I've had my own experiences, but I'll tell you right now, some people want so badly to be a part of that culture that they'll tell you anything if they think you'll believe it.
Yeah.
It's no different with ghosts. And I think that, unfortunately, probably some of the more incredible EVPs that I've been allowed to hear over the years were probably hoaxes. But there are just a handful that indeed seem to indicate that there may be certain things that for whatever reason and under whatever circumstances could allow for it, do allow strange voices to be recorded at various times that seem to have relevance to questions that are being asked or to a particular location, perhaps. And I couldn't begin to explain why that occurs. But if it does, that's fascinating.
Now, I'll tell you, I've gotten personally myself, and I wouldn't believe it if I, had heard it from somebody else. I'd be like, yeah, all right. But they weren't in response really to anything I was asking, but the EVP was so clear, it was scary.
Really?
Yeah, I'm kind of gazing through to see if I can find it to play it for you. But
oh, gosh, yeah, I'd love to hear that. And if not, maybe you can email it to me afterward regardless, because, again, that's something I'm incredibly fascinated with. I met a fellow years ago, I think he was with an organization called the Indiana Ghost Trackers. His name was Mike McDowell, and I've had, various contact with him, over the years, but it's been fairly fleeting. Haven't stayed in direct contact with him for a long time. He visited Asheville years ago and let me hear of a number of EVPs that he'd recorded that seemed very legitimate, and they obviously were saying things that were relevant to the conversation. And one time it was funny because he, talking about some of the funny things that people say that appear on EVPs, they'd been having a meeting at Denny's restaurant one evening, and they were recording the conversation, and they just put a little digital recorder in the middle of the table, and you could hear people kind of ruffling papers and talking and kind of chatting informally
about
what's going on. They weren't actually holding the official meeting, and at one point during the audio, you can hear two voices that sound like they're right next to the microphone, and they're whispering, and one says, "What does he want from us?" And the other voice says, "I don't know, but I think he wants our money."
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Now let me set this up, because I found them.
Okay.
This was at a one of the historic buildings here in Wheeling. It's turned into a museum now. There's nobody living there, and there's no electricity. And it was just me and my group. We had recorders set up on each floor. And this is something that we actually heard three different times on three different recorders, but this is the clearest one. Okay?
He'll have to email it to you, because that really didn't come over real well. But I've heard the original recording.
Yeah, I'll definitely send it to you. Check, and here's another one. I'm just going to play you one more. It's real quick.
Sure.
And again, that was in complete silence. That's something we didn't hear audibly at all.
But those shouting noises, you actually managed to record like that.
Yes.
Wow, yes. I'll tell you, if there's any way, and I'll keep that confidential, if you'd like to email those to me.
Oh, yeah. But, I mean, those are so clear that I'm like, if I wasn't there and I didn't know the circumstances of that building myself. All right, this is, okay. I'm going to play this too. Lola's going to be mad. Well, I mean, she won't. But my cousin Nick and I, we called this the Ghost of George Bush. But it to me, like, okay. The one I played last sounded like the kid yelling, right?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Well, in this one, it sounds like you can hear in the background the stop, or whatever from the kid. I don't know how well it'll come over on this, but it sounds like somebody going, yee-haw!
It's Dick Cheney hunting.
That's all right, here we go.
Okay, it does sound like George after a couple beers, doesn't it?
Right?
I presume these were recorded at night, right?
Yes.
And you guys were in that building. It was just you.
Oh, it was just us. There was nothing, and we had every floor covered. I mean, we made sure we had two guys on each floor, and we had recorders everywhere, and we were monitoring everything.
See, that's really strange, and it makes me wonder. And I'll tell you something that I wonder about, honestly. Coming back to Mac, who called in and had asked, or Hank, I'm sorry.
Yes.
Hank that called in and had wanted to know about whether ghosts can hurt people. In a lot of these instances, I think that what we're seeing when we experience various different kind of spirit phenomena are not so much, and I'm not the first person who's ever put this out, so this isn't anything innovative, but I mean it is a tenet of what I have begun to think is a likely possibility in terms of how or why these things tend to manifest. I think that a lot of the time the idea of the repeater is what we're experiencing. In other words, you know, a kind of a replaying of a past event.
Like a residual?
Yeah,
yes,
loop.
Exactly. The sort of residual haunting as opposed to there being an actual physical presence. Now, what's curious is that some people say that they've sensed that, you know, a spirit interacts with them. And I've wondered, well, what if there was indeed some sort of a time slip phenomenon, or to borrow Madeline L'Engle's, you know, the title of her novel, A Wrinkle in Time, you know, that would allow some sort of a kind of rift and maybe even a communication transcending space and time between an individual from the future and an individual from maybe the past. I've thought maybe that could account for how certain interactive qualities are maintained throughout these experiences. But that doesn't explain why, for instance, like at Reynolds Mansion, there was a woman who visited the location. And actually, I think I could probably tell you her name because she's a well-known psychic. Her name was Christy Robinette.
Uh-huh.
Christy, she visited Reynolds Mansion and claimed in what used to be the master bedroom of Daniel Reynolds that a young girl appeared before her, and that the young girl said, when she was asked, "Why you're here? Why are you still here, young girl?" She says, "Well, I was embalmed here."
Yeah.
Okay, I was embalmed here. Now, why in the world would an embalming have occurred in a house? That makes no sense. Come to find out, old Nat Augustus Reynolds, who was one of the descendants of Daniel, who owned the building up until maybe the middle part of the 20th century, had actually not only been involved in the funeral operation business here in Asheville, but he had also operated part of that funeral business from a building adjacent to the property where, guess what, took place on a frequent basis.
Wow.
So, now, that was not known by Christy Robinette. And in fact, I don't think that the present owners of the Reynolds Mansion could have even known that at that time. They found out about that later. And that perhaps lends some credence to Christy's claims that she'd seen this young girl who had said, "Yeah, I was embalmed here." Very interesting. And what's even more interesting about that is that if it were indeed just a replaying of an event or an individual, you know, kind of appearing in some sort of a parallel time to our own, well, then why would that young girl have been talking about having been embalmed? That does indeed seem to indicate, by virtue of her saying, "Yeah, I was embalmed here," that the spirit of that individual, you know, a deceased spirit, seemed to have lingered over. But I don't think that that discounts the potential for a residual kind of haunting. I think that there are indeed probably multiple different kinds. And then again, a lot of people would also say that whole situation is questionable because a psychic was involved. But I again ask, how could you have known about the embalmings that took place there? That's not common.
There's so many different categories of hauntings.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, most people are like, "Oh yeah, well, it's either smart or it's residual." But I mean, we've had people with stories like, even with, like, areas with great emotion will hold on to that emotion and play the emotion. So it goes beyond just a residual. You know, you can have a brand new jail and have a haunted jail because there's so much emotion being played. It can be a guy crying in his cell every night, crying his eyes out, missing his family. He finally gets to go home, and the next guy comes in and says, "Oh, my God, there's somebody crying in the cell every night. I can hear him, you know." And it's just because there was such emotion left over or recorded or, you know, however you want to say that, when nobody had even passed away there.
Yeah, and I think that sounds like hocus pocus to a lot of people, you know, when you talk about there's an energy here, you know, and the old expression, you know, from Star Wars where Han Solo says, you know, "Hokey ancient religions are no match for a good blaster by your side." I think a lot of people look at ghost hunting and the science of spirituality and you know, the science of what I like to call collectively psychic research. I think they look at it and they think, you know, when you hear these people coming in and talking hocus pocus and "I feel an energy here," it's just crazy talk. I don't think that at all. My reason for that is because, having been someone who went from looking at this primarily from a spiritual kind of perspective, you know, I think we all do growing up, and then you go into the kind of rational area where you begin to look at things and you start trying to implement scientific tools and instruments and things. And then for me, it went one step beyond that, and I start thinking philosophically and logically about things, and I start kind of shying away from the use of meters for reasons I've already put forth.
Uh-huh.
And I start thinking, you know, maybe there is something to the base experience. A person walks into a room, and for whatever reason, they see something they cannot explain. They interpret it to be as something, you know, maybe emanating from another time or from the spirit of an individual who lived in another time. We can't explain it, but at the base, you know, level, I think at the bottom of it all, we want to have that experience, and we want to have that kind of verification for ourselves. That's the whole reason for scientific inquiry into these sorts of things to begin with, is that we want to have answers. And each of us as individuals, some of us less than others, some people say, keep that stuff away from me. I don't want to hear about any of it. But I know for people like yourselves and like me, we come into it because we want answers and we want to understand. And therefore, what's at the root of that experience? You know, it's having that experience for yourself and being there.
What Jordan was saying about energy trapped in a building, I have always believed that a house, particularly a house, holds the energy of all of the people that have lived there in the past. And I know that from personal experience, move into one place and it's like your life goes to crap. And then you find out the people that had lived there before you and their life had been, you know, had gone bad in some ways. And then you move with the same people, the same kind of circumstances still in your life, but you move into a different apartment or house where the energy is better and life gets better. And it's always you find out after the fact, you know, the people that lived there before you had been happy and had had a happy life. It's just, I think the buildings themselves hold the energy, too.
I think that there's a strong potential for that. And if that weren't the case, Lola, then why in the world would we be hearing about haunted houses all the time, right?
Yeah.
So I think that there's a clear case to be made for the way that a physical structure can maintain that energy, whatever it is. And call it hocus pocus if you want to, but I mean, if you think about things, and I'm sure that the rocket scientists and the quantum physicists out there in the listening audience are going to cringe when they hear me saying this, but really at the root of physics and the study of physics and the physical universe, it's all energy anyway. You know, in my study of UFOs, I've tried to understand what the interrelationship is between gravity and electromagnetism, for instance. And digging into that, come to find that really, although there are a lot of theories about it, one being that at the time of the Big Bang, there was just one kind of energy, and that every manifestation of weak and strong forces, electromagnetism, and, of course, gravity, that all of these things are really just different kind of manifestations of a single kind of ever-present universal energy. I mean, think of them like different fingers on a single hand. It's all part of one hand, right? Well, in physics, it very well may be that all the energies around us are interrelated on such a level that we don't yet, by virtue of our own limitations as three-dimensional physical beings, we aren't able to perceive them on the grander level that they actually are, on that existence, that level of existence and perception that they actually are. And so in terms of physics, everything really is energy. Everything right down to the atoms and the molecules that we are comprised of, it's all vibration and energy, and people like to try and dispute that, but in truth, really, that is what we all are. That is what everything is. And we hear about quantum entanglement. We hear about, you know, these hotly contested and debated experiments that have been taking place, with CERN, where they've been observing what appear to be particles that are moving more fast, than the speed of light, and therefore that should be knocking off its base some of the theories of Einstein. Now, I've spoken with physicists who say this is incredible. This is a groundbreaking scientific experience, and not just that, but also a real, this is going to be a milestone in our understanding of the physical universe. And there are others who are saying the entire experiment is flawed, and here's why,
Yeah.
I don't think we'll ever really reconcile. I think there's always going to be dispute, but I don't think that you can dispute the fact that at the basis of everything and all fundamental existence in this universe, there is energy, and that is indeed something that can manifest in a lot of different ways, which we obviously have not yet explained and fully understood.
Here's a question I got, and it kind of goes off the topic just a little. Well, I mean, just the... Oh, Lola.
Just go on, Jordan.
Anyway,
go ahead, Jordan. Talking
about haunted places, right? You get such mixed ideas about haunted cemeteries. What are your thoughts there? Because mine is, what does that ghost have to do with that cemetery anyway? Because nobody dies in a cemetery. Right. You know, it's been like a week or so before they even get there.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, which reminds me of another question. You know, if the essence of the spirit that manifests is the very essence of the living body that existed, then why aren't ghosts naked? Why do ghosts manifest wearing clothes? It sounds kind of funny, doesn't it?
Well, maybe they are. You know, we're the ones that put clothes on them. They're flying fancy free.
Maybe there is some aspect, about, and this gets into the idea of the interconnectedness, you know, the kind of, a lot of people get, again, ill with me when I refer to it as being, you know, kind of a quantum connectedness, you know,
but
when we talk about quantum entanglement and spooky action at a distance, we do see that quantum particles can influence one another over a great distance and presumably over an infinite amount of space between them, you know, and one is affected in one way and there's a like change that occurs over this great distance. Once two particles are separated in such a way, and this is what I think that the relativists would call spooky action at a distance. But, you know, relating that to what we're talking about here, there does seem to be an interactive element with regard to the human condition and the way that we perceive psychologically phenomena around us, whether that be strange phenomena or just things we observe in our day-to-day existence, and then the kinds of manifestations, whether they be ghosts or UFOs or anything else. And like you said, who's to say that maybe it isn't something that we almost project onto these experiences ourselves, and therefore we perceive them as being, you know, ghosts or spirits and, you know, who knows, wearing clothing or flashing lights at us from the sky and all these other things. And it comes down to this. We don't really know what role that we as observers play in all this. Think about how particles can behave as both a wave form or wave function and also as, well, a particle. You know, when we're talking about photons and light energy, and the act of observing them will often, in repeated experiments, change that behavior from wave-like to particle-like. And this is something that, you know, again, I think begs the question, what role do we play as observers in all this? And the ufologist Jacques Vallée, when asked if he believed that we might have lived past lives and things, he says, I don't know, and I can only speculate maybe that we have, but also would wonder if perhaps sometimes we don't pick up things that we've you know, reflections, if you will, from future lives that we may have lived as well. Why don't we ever ask those kind of questions, guys? You know, past, present, and future, probably.
We had we had somebody on one time that said it was interdimensional bleeding, like bleed through.
I like that, you know.
But
that
was interesting.
But what is dimensionality, too? You know, we still don't understand time. And if anything, my theory is that time is probably far more spatial, and that, who knows, there could be intelligences and presences in this universe that can transcend time, like you and I could walk from one end of a room to another. And if that's the case, then I think a lot of this stuff would be explained, and the inescapable pressure that we feel with trying to reconcile with it stems from, again, our own limitations as three-dimensional beings.
Now, we are out of time, but I want to ask... Lola's sad. I think last time we had Lola got sad when it was time to go too.
Oh, darn. I missed you guys already.
Go ahead and plug your website, plug the Graylian Report. Tell us what that is real quick.
Absolutely. It's www.graylianreport.com. That's G-R and then the word alien. And while you're at graylianreport.com, I want to direct people to looking at the toolbar at the top of the page where you've got everything, you know, all the information about the, you know, my book and everything like that. But there's a huge event that we're going to be putting on in Minnesota in October of this year. Scotty Roberts of Intrepid Mag and I are doing this together. It's called the Paradigm Symposium. There's information right there, and we're going to have a website up by the end of this week. You don't want to miss this. I'm going to be at this. We've got George Norrie. We've got Bill Burns from History Channel's UFO Hunters. A lot of great names. And
wow.
Really, it's going to be a real true paradigm-shifting event, and hence we call it the Paradigm Symposium, so don't miss out.
That's great. When is that?
It's going to be October 11th through the 14th of this year. It's going to be in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and I expect to see both of you there.
Well,
it's going to be incredible.
We're definitely going to get in touch with you before that and have you back on. That way we can plug that a little.
Great. That'll be fantastic. And guys, anytime I can join you on the air, it's always my pleasure.
We really enjoy it, too.
Excellent.
Micah Hanks, thank you very much, sir.
All right, my friends. I'll talk to you soon.
See ya. I liked having him last time.
I know.
I'm happy. And it's one of those that you forget. I mean, because we get somebody new every week. At least I try to. And I always tell all these past guests, oh, yeah, we're going to have you back. And, you know, there's always somebody else emailing me or something like that.
I'm glad we had Mike on.
I wrote one of the publicists, and I was asking about some ghost shows, and she gave me three names. Of course, you know, Nick Redfern, who, you know, has got some scheduling issues with the show at the moment with his work. Because he was going to come on, and then there was one we just had on, and then there was Micah, and I'm like, Micah? And I listened back through the show, and I'm like, I love this guy! You know, and there was one at the end, it's like, oh yeah, we're definitely going to have you back. I'm like, alright, we're getting a hold of him, and I went through my email till I found him. I was like, alright, you're definitely coming. So I'm glad. We're out of time. Until next week, everybody. Don't be afraid. Only believe.